I'm David Reed, and most of you know me. And I actually, how long am I taking, or is this an indefinite? When will people?
The movie doesn't start until 11.
I'll give you. How about a 45-minute timer, including questions?
That's fine. I mean, okay. I just don't want to like just get wound up and then have to stop.
Here it is. Okay, so.
So David gave me the challenge of doing some kind of discussion around basically what he said was talk something about cooperation gate, which is a term I invented a while ago, and I've never actually given a talk about cooperation gate, even though I occasionally stick it into talks, and so I thought I'd do a slightly more extensive rant and encourage people to react. I'm not quite sure how this is going to work because I can just talk. But what it did get me thinking about is sort of how long this idea that cooperation actually creates value and that that's completely intertwined with networking has been in my life. And it sort of feels like that's really been, although I've done lots of things, that's really been what it's always been about in one way or another. And as I was looking through things that reminded me of that, I was also thinking about being old, and one of the things that old people get to do is reminisce. So back when I was about 15 years old, which was before I was doing much with computers, I was actually a programmer, but I wasn't, you know, I was just learning to do stuff like write programs. This guy, J.C.R. Licklider, and this other guy, Bob Taylor, wrote a really interesting paper, which probably was, although I didn't know it at the time, the context of what I would be doing for the rest of my life. And some of you have seen this. It's called The Computer as a Communication Device. And I just wanted to read the first paragraph of it, because in some sense it was the beginning of the Internet. It was the Internet long before Vint invented the term. But I think all of us who did something with it were kind of influenced by that, not least because Lick was running DARPA at the time, and Bob Taylor was assisting in running DARPA and went off to form Xerox PARC. And they did get the whole project started, among other things. But what I wanted to say, because this talk is really about metaphors and how metaphors get you to think differently. So this is a metaphor. So here, and this was a groundbreaking metaphor. So the
is
first few paragraphs.
Is this something that's being projected,
no,
or are these
no,
just notes?
No, I'm just
okay,
gonna, these
you.
Are just
there's
notes. So here's the first few paragraphs. In a few years, men will be able to communicate more effectively through a machine than face-to-face. That is a rather startling thing to say in 1967. But it is our conclusion. As if in confirmation of it, we participated a few weeks ago in a technical meeting held through a computer. In 2 days, the group accomplished with the aid of a computer what normally might have taken a week. We shall talk more about the mechanics of this meeting later. It is sufficient to note here that we were all in the same room. But for all the communicating we did directly across that room, we could have been thousands of miles apart and communicated just as effectively as people over that distance. Our emphasis, and this is the part that I really like, and is more than the fact that the metaphor was shifting there, our emphasis on people is deliberate. A communications engineer thinks of communicating as transferring information from one point to another in codes and signals, in bits. But to communicate is more than just to send and receive between two points. Do two tape recorders communicate when they play to each other and record from each other? Not really, not in our sense. We believe that communicators have to do something non-trivial with the information they send and receive. And we believe that we are entering a technological age in which we will be able to interact with the richness of living information, not merely in the passive way we have been accustomed to using books and libraries, but as active participants in an ongoing process, bringing something to it through our interaction with it and not simply receiving something from it by our connection to it. And then it goes on. I mean, it's a wonderful paper, and I recommend rereading it if you ever get a chance. If you Google computer as a communication medium, you'll find it.
Pete has already put the URL up on the chat.
Oh, good. Excellent. So
it's right to do that. Yeah.
Google is your
that's
friend.
A PDF file.
So what's really interesting is that to me, is how far we've gone backwards from that time. Because here was a synthesis that communications was about people embedded in information. And here we are in a meeting where I would say that the predominant metaphor for communications is one that I will read to you in just a second. Even among us, and we should know better, here's a literal quote from a very famous person. The internet is not something you just dump something on. It's a truck. It's not a truck. It's a series of tubes. Okay. Now, there's two things wrong with that. One is that it's not literally a series of tubes. But the other thing is that for all the work Vint did and we did and so forth, to answer the question that the internet has something to do with the plumbing, with the wires, with the whatever it is, you know, the hardware, the switches, the protocols, is to completely miss the point. Okay? And we miss the point all the time. And why do we miss the point? It's really interesting to try to understand why we miss the point. Because if you don't understand that point, you don't understand this phenomenon of cooperation gain. You don't understand what the internet did. If you focus just on things like the end-to-end argument and so forth, which I think are fundamental, but they're not really the point. In some sense, they're the opposite of the point. They're the negative space in which the positive value of the internet is created, right? But we continue with other kinds of metaphors. Here's another metaphor. The core unit, I read this, I'm quoting papers that are influential papers today now. Here's one. The core unit of congestion control is the flow. Now, many of you technical people know exactly what I'm referring to. The non-technical, slightly less technical people don't realize that the word flow is a mathematically defined thing that corresponds to a series of packets between two specific internet addresses as seen by a router in the middle, and the flow is literally a mathematical object consisting of those packets. Right. So the core unit of congestion control, which is actually a model of how the internet shares resources among the people, has been converted into a mathematical object that has something to do with you know, numbered packets, right? And I ask, why do we think that? And then finally, I had a conversation recently with somebody about solving a communications problem, sort of, and he said, without thinking, and I just wrote it down because this is sort of the unthinking, what you want is a virtual circuit. I said, well, why do you want a virtual circuit? No one asked that question anymore. What you want is a virtual circuit, right? So with that, I want to take a slightly different paper. And this is a paper I taught in one of my classes recently, and it's a wonderful paper. Again, I recommend it. It's not about the internet at all, but it's about networks. This paper is by a woman named Evelyn Fox Keller, who's a biologist.
She's here in West Elm.
Yeah. And she was one of the most amazing biologists because she also related the scientific process to gender and things like that in a deeply profound way as opposed to a sort of surface way. And this paper actually represents a little bit of that. But she's well known for working with slime molds. And
scientists?
That's good. So the paper is called The Force of the Pacemaker Concept in Theories of Aggregation in Cellular Slime Mold. Not a promising title, but actually it's a really wonderful paper. And what I wanted to do is read a something here out of the middle of the paper and just point out, first of all, most people probably don't really know what a slime mold is. A slime mold is a multicellular organism that's a collection of amoeba-like things most of the time. And they sort of look like slime. You know, it's sort of a pool of goo, typically on the forest floor. And every once in a while, usually when resources are scarce, they do an amazing thing, which is, first of all, they start sort of coalescing together, and then they sort of, I wish I had a movie of this, but and there are movies online, of course, they start forming a stalk that kind of looks like a flower or something. and it's sort of the stock comes up and so forth. And then something interesting happens. Many slime molds, then sort of the stock falls over and starts behaving like a worm and locomotes as a worm to some new location where they then sort of turn back into a slime mold. And the mystery to the biologist is, what the heck is it doing and how does it do that? Okay, and what's interesting is that Evelyn Fox Keller, studying this, she's sort of a mathematical biologist, came across some work by Alan Turing that is described in the book. And she basically discovered what's called the Jabotinsky reaction or whatever, which is a self-synchronizing, oscillating, periodic reaction that happens due to various things going on. And she noticed that that was an interesting phenomenon and wondered if it matched the slime molds, and she did a model of that and showed that up to a certain point it kind of matched the behavior of slime molds in the face of a resource degradation, and proposed that that was the case. And a few years later, and this is the interesting part, after proposing this and writing a paper on it, she, and sort of studying the actual biology of it, you come to this point where she says, nonetheless, shortly after Siegel and I published our model, Keller and Siegel, 1970, an earlier model, which is called the initiator cell view, was revived by Cohen and Robertson with considerably more detailed description of how signals emitted by a particular kind of cell called a pacemaker cell would coordinate and get together and kind of organize the slime mold and then form the essentially lead the slime mold into forming this stalk and then forming some kind of intelligent structure inside itself that caused it to turn into the worm and proceed. And she talks about the literature of this. And this goes on for some time. And they kind of forgot about her paper, even though she was well-known and Siegel was well-known. And for many, many years, people spent a lot of time looking for these cells called the pacemaker cells. You know, electron microscopes, all kinds of things, trying to find exactly where were they, what caused them to happen. And it turned out, up to this point in time, nobody has ever found a pacemaker cell. But what's interesting is that, if you sort of read through the paper, there was a stronger and stronger reaction against Evelyn Fox Keller's work, because it didn't make any sense. To have organization, you have to have a leader. You have to have hierarchy, right? It would be insane to have such structure, you know, evolving and solving a problem and so forth without a centralized leader emerging from the mass, probably by some kind of differentiated process, to, you know, like a mutation or God knows what, and, you know, and so forth. And so you get this thing where people start talking about the leader as a radio tower that's radiating pheromones and, you know, signaling everything, get organized and pull together and stuff like this. So this goes on for some time. And finally, after about 8 or 10 years, Evelyn Fox Keller finally gets some credit for having come up with the earlier model, basically after having gotten other people, other male scientists, it turns out, having accepted the model and going forward. Now, this is not so much a matter of discrimination against women, because I think she would be one of the first to claim that it wasn't about per se sexism. That what she actually believes and tries to express in this paper is that, you know, there's sort of two hierarchies going on here. One is the hierarchy of science, which exists whether you like it or not, and is oriented around perhaps, you know, it's not in her paper, but perhaps around the idea that there ought to be leaders and they ought to be charismatic and they ought to, you know, stand up in front of rooms and give theories and have everybody do exactly what I'm doing. And then in fact, we had a faculty meeting the other day where somebody was objecting to this wonderful scientist who was trying to work with students trying to learn by focusing on the students' learning and learning from the students' learning. And I have to say, several people, all women and men, said, but she has, this is a woman, by the way, but she has no theory. How can we hire somebody that has no theory? and said, well, science isn't about starting with a theory and proving it. It might be the other way around, finding data and figuring out what model fits it. Right? Interesting debate, but there is a strong notion of a theory. Right? So the problem is that associated with organization is this fundamental metaphor of organization equals leader. Right? So the idea that there could be an organization without a leader is extremely interesting. And the reason I brought all that up is because I've spent a lot of my career trying to find ways to build networks without leaders, as many of us have. Both technically leaders, because they have all kinds of problems. They're single points of failure. There are limits on growth. There are all kinds of other things like that. And to understand those networks in the world that seem to work without leaders, like slime molds, runs into the problem that everybody assumes there are leaders there too, right? So how can you study networks without leaders when people keep attributing leadership?
David, are you interspersing organization and network to this?
So
I just want to make sure I
follow. I am doing that, and deliberately so, partly because I think the other metaphor we use for network, or for communications networks now, is the wrong metaphor also, which is like we say, oh, a network must be a collection of wires, tubes, virtual wires, things that sort of web things together, right? But if you actually look at the world, the webbiness, the hardwiredness of things is very thin, right? The most successful platforms we've built, like the World Wide Web, doesn't have any pre-wired connections at all. The way it's going to, you know, most... When you talk about spidering the web, the technical problem of spidering the web is that there's no web. There are these things called URLs, which are changing all the time. So how do you spider something that's not a fixed structure? Well, that's why Google gets paid the big bucks. But the metaphor is fundamentally wrong. And that's, you know, what one of the challenges is that you get a lot of designs that start with a really flawed metaphor and try to make it work as if it really is the flawed metaphor that you think it is. So, how many years of mathematical biology were applied to these slime molds, making the assumption that there were pacemaker cells, right? And no one questioned it. Well, actually, as she points out, and I'm not going to read the appropriate paragraph, occasionally you'd find in these papers the assumed pacemaker cells. But usually you'd find the pacemaker cells as if they must exist and they just had to be found, right? And so, I'm coming to metaphors as a way that unthinkingly shapes our thought. Okay, so another metaphor, and this gets to the cooperation game thing, is the assumption, very common assumption. In fact, I wish I had the quote for it. There's a great quote in a wonderful book by Richard Rhodes, which I forget the title, but it basically talks. It has zillions of quotes about technology over the last 100 years, roughly one page quotes. And one of the quotes talks about it's basically some engineer at NASA or something saying, every time somebody comes along, they say there must be a limit, and some scientists will assert there's a limit, and they'll state there's a limit, and if you stick around long enough, that limit wasn't a limit, right? Basically, it says it much more cleverly than that. And we live in sort of metaphors that are inherently limited, and sometimes it seems amazing to me how humans get the idea that there's only a finite amount of any kind of stuff you can name as a noun, right? So a few years ago when I was talking about spectrum here, I got very excited about the idea that spectrum could be mapped to property. And the reason is that it's mapped to property is, if you go back and read Coase or you read the only Supreme Court decision that actually acknowledged that the FCC was not unconstitutional, both of them say that the reason that we need to manage spectrum is because there's a finite amount of it. It says it's a scarce resource. In Coase, it starts off and says, we assume, because radio engineers know this, that there's only so many frequencies. And therefore, we must treat it as property. So when I, 12 years ago, sort of asked a slightly different question, which is how many bits per second can the ether carry based on the laws of physics? Mm-hmm. And I found that there's no answer to that, right? It's sort of, it's, first of all, the answer is not well known, and second, if whatever it is, it's not correlated to the number of frequencies or the, you know, and other things. And there are reasonably good arguments that it's actually relatively unlimited, but I don't want to bore you with that. But the idea, the metaphor that everything that you can name is limited, you know, so that's what I'm saying, is if you can name it, if you can assign it a noun, there must be so much of it and no more, is sort of our fundamental limit. So when we say the internet, we've already named something and we assume there's a limit to it and it must be managed and it must be allocated, right? So when you say the internet is something else, and this is where I want to get to, so what is the internet more like? Is it more like a bunch of tubes? Or, as I've sometimes said, the internet is like the English language. Okay, it's not like the French language. And you probably understand why I make that distinction, right? Because they have the illusion in France that there's somebody in control of the French language. Mm-hmm. They have that French Academy who defines what's legal French and what's not. But we've managed to live with a language that nobody claims to be in control of, much well. Some people claim to define what's good English.
No, they're these pacemaker language makers.
Right, right. So, and then the other question is, so where does the English language come from? Right. It's perhaps the most interesting form of internet we've ever had, right? So, you know, if you think about the Victorian internet, what would you call the Anglo-Saxon internet or whatever? I don't know, where did the English language come from, right? Or, and, you know, you don't have to use the English language. You could use all languages, you know, which is, you know, we have created a set of protocols that are truly universal and are not produced by a centralized organization. They're not managed by an IETF. And it would be really nice to figure out how that was done and how it continues to work, because I claim it's so obvious that the English language works that we don't ever question it.
Can I just interrupt with one thought? Languages do die, and that's very distressing because of the analog that you're drawing here with the internet, rather than it didn't die. The English language is remarkable in its ability to absorb new and invent new terms and expressions, and so that's encouraging. But then there are these other languages that did die, and it might be interesting to know how strong your analogy should be drawn. And whether we can learn anything from the death of a language, is there a threat to internet because of some, you know, the process that causes the language to die, could also cause the net to die?
Well, that's why I think of myself as a scientist, which is that I'm much more interested in studying how these things happen than I am in trying to control them. Because if we were trying to control the internet, this is the one thing that's pretty clear to me about the internet, is that there were a lot of things that it was supposed to be for, and in some ways it more or less hit those marks, but not along the paths that anybody was trying to cause it to. Right. So the World Wide Web is a great example. It's probably a terrific example of exactly what Licklider and Taylor were describing. But I think they probably had something more along the lines. Well, I know that at the time they were thinking of Doug Engelbart's marvelous
NLS.
Information sharing system called NLS, which was the product of one or two very brilliant minds, not the product of a whole collection of people who threw things out there and something finally coalesced.
So should we summarize this by the internet as what happens when you were planning something else?
Very, very good. I like that. Right. So let me talk a little bit more focused. Right, internet just happens. Yeah. Internet happens.
Yeah. Right.
So what's interesting is that, you know, in 1976, I'm just going to sort of bop back to a few things. The ARPANET had demonstrated the value of packet networks, right? And that was a pretty amazing thing. And at the same time, personal computers were emerging at Park and Cambridge University and MIT and Carnegie Mellon, as sort of an interesting idea, these little workstation things. And Vint had this, or Vint and Bob and some other collection of people, I don't know really who to attribute the idea of interoperability to, but it was this genius idea that and really had a personal, huge personal impact on me, because I was working on local area networks and I thought they were pretty special and different, right? And I had this guy Bob Kahn come into MIT and say, hey, you think you're working on something special and different, but we don't want you to do that. We wanted you to be part of this other thing. It was very frustrating for a few weeks until it was, became fun to hang out with those guys, right? But interoperability was why. The idea that we should have one language, not many, right? And interoperability is still controversial, right? I mean, think about the metaphor of interoperability. It was controversial at the time because people said, well, why do we want to share a network between the, you know, the military confidential stuff and the rest of the world that's not nowhere near as important as the kind of, you know, top secret stuff that we transmit on the military switches. And that was a pretty, well, Vin knows about that. I don't know very much about that. I deal with that level of politics. But the but we now have the idea that in order to get really good networks, we have to carve them off and have them owned by somebody, right? Mm-hmm. And isolated and protected. And mm-hmm. Verizon will, I was at DiceBand, which was really interesting, the first DiceBand conference, and this guy from Verizon stood up. They were a sponsor, which is good. But he first said, I want you to know that this idea of interoperability is a terrible idea, because what we do, what we do is we guarantee really solid industrial class performance. And your cell phone never fails because we have complete control of it, and you wouldn't want that internet stuff in this. Right? And I was quiet. I did not jump up and say, I have a Verizon cell phone, and man, calling that quality is not quite
it's
so
the network.
Good. it was the CTO of Verizon Wireless was the guy. I forget his name. I collect these sort of silly ideas because, for some reason, I tend to disagree with almost all of them and sort of jump out at me with people. But this was actually an accepted idea, you know, that we should move toward industrial strength, you know, fixed function networks because they're good, right? And so, I actually, at the time in 1976, had a friend who went to work on the Intelligent Network, or its predecessor, the all packet network that Bell was building down in Bell Labs. And they used to come up and visit us where we were playing around with local area nets and say, oh, you guys, you know, you're just academics. You don't know what you're doing, right? Because we're doing the real solid stuff. And they said, you know, you can't do phone calls over that. He said, yeah, we know we can't do phone calls over that. I said, but phone calls are the only things that matter. He said, well, okay, you're entitled to your opinion. It's still the case that a large collection of people that work for those companies still think phone calls are all that matter. These isochronous 64 kilobit things that are sacred and go from a number to a number, not a human to a human. So how do we not break those metaphors? Well, those metaphors may be wired into our consciousness. But what's interesting to me is I'm trying to evolve some new metaphors. And so here's a metaphor that I've been talking about for a while, and this I'd like you to think about. First of all, because the old metaphors of the internet are getting kind of old, and they're actually getting in our way, even though they were great. Right? So I'm trying to get people beyond those metaphors, but beyond them in a constructive way, because the typical reaction of people to say, to a lot of engineers, to the end-to-end argument or to the idea that, you know, interoperability is good, is to go back to the old stuff. So you see people saying, you know, we got to get back to that old, you know, dedicated light pipe things, or time domain multiplexed virtual circuits that have guaranteed latency, because that's what we really needed all along. This internet has been a mistake, and we're getting back to the real stuff. You know, the metaphor. But there's a different way to think about this, and the thing I want to talk about is phase transitions. Okay? When you think about really large amounts of stuff, what condensed matter physicists think about. There's another great paper which I will only cite called More is Different by a guy, P.A. Anderson, that was in Science Magazine, that talks about why physicists are now split into two camps, those that focus on one thing at a time, and those that focus on zillions of things, right? And they don't talk to each other very well. And the ones who do condensed matter physics are much more interesting. When you have lots of things, you have the opportunity to have something called a phase. And in physics, that's like solids, liquids, gases, and stuff like this. And I would claim that there's an interesting metaphor that we haven't really exploited, which is the idea that what the internet did was actually melt the world of communications. So the world of communications melted as the internet evolved from a solid to a liquid. And let me just tell you what some of the characteristics of a solid and a liquid are to set the stage for that. I have to remind myself what a solid and a liquid are, and so I went to Wikipedia, which is the place where you learn everything, at least the first draft of anything that you want to learn. The Wikipedia article on phase change is quite nice. It's probably different now than when I read it. And basically it says, phases are emergent phenomena produced by self-organization of a macroscopic number of particles. In systems that are too small, the distinction between phases disappears. And the key distinction between a gas and a liquid is this notion of compressibility. And I probably learned that at one time, but it's worth remembering that the difference between a gas and a liquid is the liquid has roughly constant volume, but no fixed shape. And the key difference between a liquid and a solid is this notion of rigidity. That is like a board. If you hold the end of it, it doesn't fall down or whatever, whereas liquids have no rigidity. And what that rigidity notion, which you see in a liquid versus the change between a liquid and a solid, really characterizes the difference between the Bell system as a system and the internet. Right? So we may or may not have done it intentionally, but the Bell system is designed in a very rigid, in a positive sense. You know, we used to study the engineering of the Bell system. Every piece fit in a slot, and those slots fit together perfectly, and they were all carefully engineered to achieve the function with high reliability. Right? And the internet violated all those principles. Nothing was guaranteed to fit in a particular slot. There was a sort of a rule that everything should accept any input but generate more predictable output than its input. I forget what the exact phrase is. Maybe Dave or Steve or Vince knows the answer to that.
But Postel.
Yeah, Postel came up with that. And the idea was, if you had to engineer something that was so sloppily constructed but still did something really useful in mass, you had to think very differently than think about engineering in what I would call the liquid phase. So at the very bottom level, it's kind of it's constructed in a liquid phase style of construction, which is why the AT&T engineers laughed at us every time they looked at it, because there's, you know, the number of bits in a particular field, it could be a little smaller, it could be better, it could be polished, you know, it's like, and we were saying, that's good enough. Right? In days of Moore's Law, who cares, right? Or something. So what's interesting about a liquid phase is that it's entirely emergent. And what's interesting about emergent processes of this sort are they're adaptable. In the case of a liquid, it's low energy to reshape, so you can retool it to be something else, whereas retooling the Bell system probably was impossible to do something other than telephony. It's been pretty hard. It's boundaryless, so you can actually, you know, plug more of them together. It's a solvent. This is being more metaphorical. It absorbs and diffuses new innovations more quickly than a solid would. And it has a notion of turbulence, which allows for... And if you think about what is turbulence, well, in physics, turbulence is a local emergent structure. It's not just noise. It's actually, you know, if you have a whirlpool, which is a kind of turbulence, that's an emergent structure, and it has some stability and lasts long. So things like blog networks or discussion groups or whatever emerge on an architecture like the internet and develop persistence in a way that they couldn't if you had to engineer them in every time you built a new one. Right? So liquid phase is an interesting thing. And then you start to think about, well, what does liquid phase mean? Well, there's a lot of systems that are operating in a liquid phase. And when you start looking for them, which I did when I sort of had this insight, you realize that there are some really interesting ones. The word liquidity applies to economics, right? And it's actually a meaningful technical term because it's the difference between two kinds of economic systems. Hal Varian and I had a conversation about this once where he pointed out to me something that I probably once knew and now I really know, is there's this thing called the law of one price in economics. And the law of one price is a law that applies to a liquid economic system. It doesn't apply to a barter system. Right? Sort of. In a barter system, the same good has a different price no matter where you have different parts of the system. But once you have a certain amount of liquidity, which is literal application of this metaphor, the price of one thing is the same everywhere. It's uniform. It's like pressure is diffused in a liquid. Similar things that have these phase phenomena are things like traffic networks. Languages have phase phenomena, and people productively study that. And biological systems are themselves a phase phenomena. You can't have a biological system that's not essentially in a liquid phase, although it's a more complicated phase than liquid.
You don't mind?
Go ahead. Yeah, please interrupt.
To move along the path, the liquidity and the financial side.
Right.
When the price is not the same everywhere, which it might not be, then you get effects like arbitrage.
Right.
I wonder if there's something hiding in your metaphor that would tell us something about the internet.
Right.
In that context.
Well, but as an application, people often talk, Dave Clark and other people have talked about the fact that the internet doesn't route money, right? And the idea that it's really hard to imagine how it gets paid for. And I don't have enough data, but I think this is the way to think about it, that whenever there's a piece of the internet that's not working very well, someone, very much like in an economy, there's an invisible hand that addresses resource to it, because some people do care, and some people care more about others than others. So there's a relationship between liquidity and the economy, which directs financial stuff to the right place, and liquidity in the internet, and obviously they interact strongly, even if implicitly, in that structure. And what I have not seen, and when I've looked, and I'm not deeply involved in the technical economics of the base parts of the internet, but what I've not seen anybody look at is the non-directed, the non-contractual, if you will, economic phenomena that surround the internet. It's clear that the internet has grown, right? It's clear, and if you think about how it grew in the early days and how it's growing now, there's a lot of what I would call sort of parallel play behavior, right? It's sort of like people are sort of cooperating, but they actually haven't made any deal to cooperate, or their deals are very loose, right? There's no, it's not put, the contractual structure of the internet is not put together the way the Bell system was, where you can sort of track, he made this decision because he was required to by that contract, which was required to by that contract, and so forth. Instead, it kind of just propagates.
It sounds more like enlightened self-interest.
Well, it's often
enlightened. Not the contractual kind of things you're talking about, then to restrict the liquidity?
Yeah, right. If you look at a completely contracted economy, one that has no markets,
yeah,
right, one where everything's a pairwise deal,
can I,
that's a barter economy, and it doesn't have the law of one price, and it tends to be
brittle. Can I get to the leap ahead with the next two phases? Would you tend to equate the gas phase with wireless? And then what does
I don't know yet. I don't know yet. The one problem with metaphors, as I alluded to in the beginning, is that metaphors that become too bought into by a community become dangerous, right? It's like they prevent you from looking at things in new ways. So metaphors are useful to introduce a new concept. That's
and
how
that's
humans
the whole
communicate.
Metaphor, for instance, multipath and
right.
Wireless.
So I don't know if I think of wireless as gaseous. I actually look at today's wireless economy and think this is still a solid phase economy. It's still a very engineered economy. Now, whether the technology allows you to move out of that, I think it can, and I think there's a bunch of technological steps that are sometimes analogous to the internet. We ought to be using software-defined radio to make the radios adapt to each other directly when they are in the same space and hearing each other and so forth. We're not doing that. We haven't defined an IP level of waveform compatibility, for example, or whatever. And there's lots of ways to do that. In fact, what's interesting is the internet didn't pick the magical one way to do things. Right? The IPv4 thing had zillions of flaws. It just picked one simple one that seemed to work okay, and it seemed to work okay, right? We patched around it, right?
And of course, that's been superseded by IPv6, it's even harder to deal with.
No, actually, I think the flaw of IPv6, which I'm a fan of, is that when people saw this is the next generation, they started doing a second system effect and started adding all these features that solidify the thing before it really is clear what it was good for. If IPv6 just had been longer addresses, it probably would have been a better choice.
Is that different from what I said?
Well, because I don't think IPv6 has succeeded. One of the reasons it might not be succeeding is because it's too solid a system to replace the liquid one that's good enough. So that's a thought. So one of the things that I've been trying to spend time is say, if this metaphor is interesting, and it may be and it may not, then there's a science of engineering in the liquid phase that we don't fully understand. It's like the science of understanding slime molds, you know, in the biological sense, understanding systems that don't have hierarchy. But it's an engineering science as opposed to a science of just descriptive stuff. And the question is, what can you do to design systems that have these more liquid properties and avoid the solidification of it and so forth, especially in the face of, you know, economic phenomena that are trying to solidify it all the time, right? One way to create a solid is to create a lot of cell walls in between the cells, right? So the reason the human body is kind of rigid is not because it isn't all liquid, but because we've got boundaries between everything. And those boundaries may or may not be chosen in the right place.
It seems to me that the secret of hierarchies is that they just lock in of hierarchies, fear of going someplace else.
Right.
We use healthcare to lock people into employment agreement. Mm-hmm. If you have freedom to leave a hierarchy, it loses its power.
Yep.
Okay. And if you can, we already know that open source software is a Copernican moment. Mm-hmm. By all the laws, all the accepted assumptions of managerial capitalism, as Shoshana Zuboff called it, love the term, it's impossible.
Yep.
You know, it doesn't threaten anybody so much because they're all busy using it. But the fact is, it simply is inconceivable in our socioeconomic construct. So we do know that you can form organizations that are more like gerunds than nouns. I call organization. You know, if organizing has occurred, whether or not somebody has done it, it's still an organization. It's a,
right.
I don't know if I'm using the words.
I think that's exactly the kind of thinking that I'm hoping to get other people to do besides me. Right. I'm not sure I'm a guru on this. I'm just an observer, and maybe a metaphor changer. But
right.
I think that's it. You know,
so
how does open source really work? I contribute to the Linux project, and I tell you, you know, I mean, I.
So I'm suggesting,
but I don't understand how it really works, because if you actually, until you start studying who pays who and what the hell is going on.
We have two more minutes left.
Yeah.
How much more time do you need?
I could talk for 5 hours, but
I'm
not going to.
To sort
let
of
me see.
Put a.
Let me see what I want to.
Hang on here.
Cover.
Out of order. Tell me what you need to finish what you want to say.
Okay, so I'll tell you what I need to sort of add one more. I only want to
because
throw one more ingredient into the mix.
Okay, but I want to know how. Well, hang on, wait a minute.
Yeah.
It's getting late, and we have more items on the agenda. So the question is, how do we manage the time?
Right. Well, I could.
It's a finite resource problem.
Right. I could stop now.
Exactly.
I could stop now.
But I really would like to see
one other idea,
which
I literally wanted to say in which would have been one slide.
Please hold your questions.
I'll say that.
Let
and
David
then,
finish.
And then I'm sure these ideas come up more, right? So the last thing that I wanted to say is that and this comes back to one other thing that I think ties into this really well, which is that there's an emerging set of thoughts about what communications really is. And it sort of rolls back to that question of Licklider and Taylor basically said, which is communications is about people. And one of the things that I observe is that we have enough critical mass of stuff, both communicating things and devices that sit around people, that there are two new models of communication that are emerging that are not at all like the models that the internet, you know, was based in. And one model is what I would call the you-centered network. Okay, the network that is centered around you. And I think of that as, first of all, it goes around with you. And the destination of that network is always you. Right. So it's the network of relationships you have. It's the network of sensing that you are interested in, like who's where, what temperature is it, where am I going, what's new over there, and so forth. So although it may be composed of ultimately wires and stuff like that, the architecture of that system is about informing you about what's going on around you and maintaining the relationship between you and the rest of the world. And I think that's the you-centered version of things. And you might see that, for example, in your Facebook page, and it might explain a little bit why people are getting more than extremely interested in networks that are centered around them, right? Which are you can see at the user interface, but more importantly, there's a whole collection of technologies below that, ranging from, you know, sort of ad hoc information, broadcasting over short distances. The fact that my smart key for my Prius opens the door when I walk up to the Prius and I don't think about it by radio, and it would be nice if it opened the door of my house and did all the other obvious things that it should do, because why should I have a key for every separate thing? It would be nice to have that interoperability. But it's the use-centered architecture. And then the other architecture that I think is relevant is the us-centered architecture. And that gets back to, I've talked a lot about the power of groups. And the other thing the internet allowed to happen, that the internet, the view of networks as just sending messages from point A to point B with no memory, really didn't accommodate. But the internet started to accommodate this notion that you build collections of things that are in constant relation to each other, virtual relationship nets, whether they're configurations of computers or the network that Facebook, you know, the individual Facebook subnets consist of, you know, the MIT people that are on Facebook versus the Big Hook people that are on Facebook. Those logically interoperate with the physical environment around you and the communications technologies, right? So one of the things one of my students is working on, just to give you an idea, is he says, why should we have to teach every device who our friends are? Okay. Why doesn't we just... And a lot of people have said, well, we could just teach people one device who our friends are and all the other devices can learn from it. But he says, actually, who our friends are is a dynamic concept. It's the people that we talk to a lot. So why doesn't the device just observe our communication? Why don't all our devices observe our communication and decide who our friends are? Right? For us, or help us decide who our friends are. And since friend and trust and security are all built around that, you start to derive an architecture that is truly us-centric, you know, in terms of the different groups that we belong to, or, you know, and that goes from the lower level to the higher level. And the question is, how do you build what would be the ISO stack of those kinds of things? One could say, well, you know, you just start off with all the bottom level ISO stacks and it only happens at the topmost layer. That would be the traditional. But when you look at that, you're throwing away lots of things. You're throwing away the fact that the lower-level networks actually are attached to you. They know what's around you. They sense and adapt. They negotiate on your behalf for resources and so forth. So the separation from those low levels is fundamentally artificial. So that doesn't mean you shouldn't have those lower layers be simple. But maybe there's an equally simple set of lower layers that are better for building stuff around. And that's where I think actually the wireless world starts to become a first-class citizen, because the wireless world actually is much more compatible with humans. The wired world is compatible with humans sitting at desks. Or actually, the old network is about desks and couches. Right? So they deliver the data. As long as you're willing to sit in front of a desk or at a couch, you get the data. Right? But we haven't yet figured out how to make, you know, the technological thing follow you, so that when I walk into your house, I can watch my TV subscription. Right? that's, you know, what, why should the TV subscription be associated with my couch? It's really associated with me. So if I get cable TV, I should get it anyway. But I think that's a deeper thing than just that one. So that's all I have to say.
What do people want to do now? Hang on here. I want to get a sense, before we get into reactions to this, I want to process check. My idea was to play a little music and then go into 5-minute talks. But I'm open to other suggestions. Do people want to discuss this?
Yes.
Yeah.
One guy says yes.
Yes.
Yes. Yes.
We should while it's fresh.
Yes.
The musician says yes.
What? The musician. You're done
yes.
playing music. Huh?
The musicians.
Yeah.
We'll play music when you all start drinking.
Well, we've done that. We started hours ago. Okay. All right. Let's.
Could I just ask about the process? Are you suggesting that it's an either or? In other words, that if we discuss this, that there are no 5-minute things, or there's a limit less of them, or you know, how much time? Do you
well,
have
right
to
now work? We only have half a dozen 5-minute things, so that's a pretty easy. It looks like it could be an on boat, especially if the musicians don't really, you know, like it. Likes like you know, but. So why don't we discuss it for a while? I'm good with that.
And what sort of time frame were you thinking of? I know you said until everybody falls asleep or goes away, but did you have in mind anything more concrete than that?
Well,
more solid, you mean?
So, yes.
Well,
liquid. Another hour.
Yes. How about if we, like, spend half an hour and then... You know, could people put their cell phones on stun? Stun.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Okay, so why go for no more than half an hour?
Let's do half an hour of discussion. David?
David,
you're the discussee.
I'm just doing my whistle, but
oh, please.
But actually,
that's a good one.
It's dangerous putting me in front of the room or all things because then I'll look like...
Why don't you go sit there?
I'm going to sit there.
Yeah, I'd rather
sit there.
I'll sit here and play traffic. Yeah, you can sit there. Okay.
David, I want you to...
I have one question.
Okay, I'm just traffic cop, and okay. Then.
So, you mentioned, by the way, a really very thought-provoking and helpful, so thank you for twisting our minds around these new metaphors. It occurred to me that the telco world could be described along the slime mold direction, because by artificially constraining resources, which benefits some of their business models, they are behaving like slime molds. So I wonder if it's okay for us to quote you as saying that the telcos are slime molds.
I was actually suggesting that the internet was more like the slime mold.
There was no permission.
Don't quote me. Just let both be true.
So all right.
What's wrong with slime mold?
No, but why can't both of those be true? That one is being a slime mold from an infrastructure point of view, and the other is being a slime mold.
Okay. Now, hang on here.
Okay.
Let's have one conversation, Greg.
Why can't both of those be true? Because you have an economic market that the telecoms are operating in, and that they are actually organizing very liquidly around policy and other things, whereas the internet is more liquid from an infrastructure point of view and behaving that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we could say that the telcos are slime and the internet's a slime mold.
In what sense are the telcos slime? Just so we get on the common ground. They're operating as
legal.
They're operating as legal entities under a regulatory regime.
No, that's
towards the end of serving their shareholders.
No. This,
okay,
is
this
a
is
large group of very frightened middle managers trying to keep their jobs. That's all. Fuck the shareholders.
Yeah. Managerial capitalism.
This is hijacked. This is a large institution.
Have you seen AT&T stock price over the last couple of years? You don't think they cared about the shareholders?
Believe me,
we're way the hell off.
Whitaker
the
cares about his retirement.
Yeah, absolutely.
But this is a large. This was a big book from 3 years ago. This is a large. If you gave them a pharmaceutical revenue stream tomorrow, they'd be a pharma company. All they want to do is keep their jobs, particularly this group of frightened sheep.
Okay.
And so I think the slime mold is a very good metaphor for the behavior. So what have they done? They've realized that the wired network isn't holding them anymore, so they're busily oozing over the wireless network. And this is why anybody with any connections in a telco is busily oozing his way out of a fix and into wireless, because there's money in wireless. And there's nothing to do. I'm dead serious. It has nothing to do with shareholders, for sure. It has everything to do with job preservation and keeping your cone of headcount.
Brett,
and we are the last guys they have to kind of keep happy at the end of the year.
Brett?
One's a sort of comment that may be in this direction, and one's sort of a tangential comment that goes in a different direction. First comment is, I'm a little bit confused by just sort of generally evoking metaphors and sort of throwing out a bunch of metaphors and trying to wondering which is the best, because the utility of a metaphor depends entirely on the questions that you're asking in terms of the comparison, right? So, and I'm not sure what the question is. So you can say this is like that, and it could be like that for certain purposes and completely unlike it for other purposes. And the question is, what's the underlying question that you're trying to use the metaphor to sort of uncover something and teach us about? That's the sort of the first thing. So I'm not sure what talking about who's a slime and who's a slime mold does anything unless we know what the underlying question is that we're trying to figure out what the metaphor is useful for. That's sort of like the first overarching question. The second point I wanted to sort of throw out there was, as I heard you talking about phases, it actually kind of rung a bell, something I've sort of been an idea I've been thinking about, which is I would have said the same or thought about the same thing, but thought of it in terms of property rights. And thought about sort of the degree to which property rights are strong is sort of the temperature gauge, right? So strong property rights lead to centralized decision making about whatever it is we're talking about, right? So it's centralized decision making allocates resources according to sort of a very particular mode of sort of market allocation. Weak property rights are sort of pushing towards the liquid side. Things are a little more flexible. There's less centralized control by whoever the property owner is, network owners, or if we're thinking in the intellectual property context, you can talk through the exact same set of issues. And the sort of decentralization, the flexibility in terms of decision making, sort of seems like you're more in a liquid phase. I'm not sure where you go as you kind of stretch that to gas and go into other phases, but at least in terms of solid versus liquid, it seems that you could be talking in terms of property rights, in which case I think the phase metaphor is actually quite useful. But again, going back to the metaphor point, I'm not sure why you're evoking phase transitions, but what is the underlying question you're trying to analyze in terms of engaging in comparison?
There are actually lots of phases when you start to look at large systems. They have lots more phases than three, right? So I was just using those as specifically a metaphor. When you start to look at economic systems, actually, I picked the example that's clearest in economics, right, between barter and market economies, right? But but what's interesting is that if you start to look at systems that are about synthetic property, for example, like options, right, sort of financial options or futures or securitized mortgage instruments or whatever, those have a very different statistical and organizational behavior, and they organize markets around them, and they probably have different phase behavior, from a statistical point of view than some of these other things, because you can make more of them stuff. So I'm only evoking the metaphor to basically cause you to sort of put on a different pair of glasses, right? And then you might say, okay, well, I understand that. Let's really analyze in a deep way that. But I'm not proposing that this is, formal mathematics. Yeah.
Yeah.
So. Hang on here. I think Tom had his hand up first.
I'd like to explore for a couple of minutes this idea of my friends are different depending upon which device I'm using. I mean, you said they weren't. I suggest they are strongly. I know that ever since I've had a portable telephone, I've kept an entirely different address book, if you like, on that phone that I keep on my computer and that I keep, that I carry around with me when I'm thinking about writing letters or visiting people. And I'm wondering if there is some, fungibility and still rigidity that one, that we need to think about if we're going to extend that metaphor.
Well, the thought experiment that I've done, and I admit it's only a thought experiment, is what if your Facebook friends list could be automatically uploaded into your cell phone? Maybe News Corp is about to do that with MySpace. I don't know. But if you did that, would that be perceived as a great feature or a bug?
Well, let me give you an example, one that I've used for the last 25 years. Back when we first talked about cell phones having, you know what multiple NAM phones are, where you could actually make a cell phone respond to different numbers?
I just heard somebody tell me last week that they've invented this really cool thing called the dual NAM phone. I said, this is kind of old, isn't it? This is, oh no, it's brand new.
I used to explain to folks when I was giving talks on this subject that I had four phone numbers that I used to give out. I had one number that I gave out to my business associates, and the second number that I gave out to folks like my mother and my kids, and the third number I gave to my wife, and the fourth to my mistress. Depending on the circumstances, I answered one or another of them.
I'm very worried.
One second. There's a bunch of other people with their hand up. Do you have further follow-up for that?
I'm trying not to respond to everybody.
Okay. Let me... Here's a question.
You're defeating the purpose, David. Okay.
Here's a question that's really basic, and I encourage people to put them up, and thank you, Doc, for asking the very basic question. In what sense is the internet, liquid?
I think that what I specifically was saying was that we moved from a design process that was focused on structures that were rigid and rigidly related to each other to structures that were very loosely coupled and very not based on rigidity. And I would sort of use the other metaphor I didn't bring in is boats float and bridges stand up based on entirely different properties, but through a liquid process versus a solid process, they both don't fall down toward the center of the earth. They both resist gravity. And so you can sort of think about, if you want to deal with gravity, you can deal with it by Archimedes' principle, or you can deal with it by, Galileo's analysis of beam strength.
So it's in a non-rigid, flexible sense then.
Right.
Yeah. I like that. I like that. I like the idea that it's a tie that lifts boats rather than a span that goes across.
Right. And we don't worry about the fact that all the molecules in the ocean might accidentally go out from underneath the boat. It would fall to the bottom.
First of all, I remind people that they have their 3-minute cards if they really want to speak. But I'm going to play fairly straight traffic cop. Because, we have our finite resources winding down. And Steve had his hand up next. And
so, you had a thought on this.
Also, I'm partial to people who state their questions simply there, and then I'll echo them. But anyway, Steve.
Okay. So, always have a problem with metaphors for the other reason, but I think there might be another interesting metaphor here if you kind of look at how phases, there's a formal study of the states of things that was developed by Gibbs around the turn of the century called phase space. And I think mathematically phase space might be a nice way to look at this. So phase space is all of the possible states of the system. And you can describe objects in phase space. So the phase space for the internet is markedly different from the phase space for for regular telco, and you can actually address that formally.
Yeah, actually, I'd love to encourage people to think that way. I don't know if it's the be-all and end-all analysis.
No, no, it's another metaphor, maybe fluffy. But
Actually, Gibbs, it's remarkable that there is an abstract theory of phase that, you know, as you say, Gibbs first can prove that there are only three phases of molecules. Like, how do you prove that there are only three phases? But in Gibbs's theory, you could prove that.
And what do you do with it after you have the phases mapped out?
Then you might actually engineer with those. I mean, you might. Gibbs's thing allows you to design, for example, steam engines or Stirling engines.
There are two kinds of scientists: physicists and stamp collectors. And so you can do stamp collecting.
Well, I think you can do that. I think the other thing is, if you wanted to ask the question, I mean, I often use this metaphor to formulate questions, if not formulate the way to answer them, is if you wanted to do resource allocation, also known as congestion control, in an internet full of multicasters, right, which is not a solved problem, maybe the best way to think about it is not think about it atomistically by designing each multicast so that it does the right thing, but create an economy for multicast, right, which probably get good enough stability to basically say, oh, well, if you multiply the number of the out degree of the trees times the flow rates times something, then you build a market for that, and that's good enough for, you know, there's a variety. Or maybe you invent a pressure model on it. Well, I mean, remarkable how congestion control works in TCP at all. And the reason it works is because there's kind of an implicit pressure model, which Scott Shanker and other people have kind of developed a mathematics for, but it didn't exist before the algorithm was invented.
Okay, Steve, what did I miss on the board?
You tend to ignore the board.
Okay, well, so what did I miss?
You've missed a lot of things.
No, well, which question for David Reed did I miss?
I didn't bother putting it up there.
well, then, out of order, next question.
Dave, you keep saying read the board, you keep saying put your stuff up on the board, but you don't look at it.
So use the eyes in the back of your head.
I'd like to make a mea culpa. He's missing his glasses, if anybody has seen them.
No, this is on.
No,
okay.
David also said at the beginning that if you see something interesting on the board, let him know.
Don't put the child in the corner that way. It's annoying.
Do you have a question for David?
Because one thing that worries me is I think the internet has developed very well because it operates in a highly constrained environment with a lot of people trying to kill it. And therefore, things like peer-to-peer, it's this thing, it's sort of like a slime mold, which is there's a lot of things trying to kill it, and so it survives. I worry as it becomes more of the dominant life form, there are fewer big things trying to kill it, and the rate of innovation slows down simply because it becomes dominant. And
One of the reasons I present alternative metaphors is because actually I share exactly that. I think the internet... I often describe the internet as kind of like IBM was when it was just about to die. And it worries me. You know, that doesn't mean there won't be another thing like the internet. I think 25 years from now, there will be something else that is the dominant life form. And our job is to discover what it is. Right? And maybe to actually make it.
Elliot.
Yeah, David, the metaphor was really useful for me in a very specific sense that you alluded to just a little bit when you talked about liquidity as an economic concept, because I think one of the things that we don't talk about enough, that isn't under a bright enough light, is the liquidity that the internet in general and Google in particular has brought to all kinds of commerce. And I'm not talking about the direct stuff, but the indirect stuff. You know, I threw a comment up there that there is a billions of dollars market in leads and the buying and trading and selling of leads. And there is a liquidity about that. When I say that, an efficiency and a liquid concept, the ability for those leads to change hands efficiently in a very, you know, clean sense, in a very fluid sense. And probably most importantly, you know, and why I like the liquid concept is that it morphs and changes and redirects itself so effortlessly. You know, there was a great story that took place, and I mean it's a morality play, over the last 12 months, but there was a company that came from nowhere 30 months ago to getting funded. They sold a minority stake for $160 million to the second largest public hedge fund. And within 3 months, both Google and Yahoo changed their policies, did nothing more than change their policies. And that company essentially spun around the bowl. So you had the smartest money making the most objective decisions in a competitive investment process. And the liquidity of that market was so tightly tethered. It was a simple change in policy. And this is happening in just about every market where things are transacting on the internet now, around the buying and selling of fleets. So I think it's a beautiful concept, and really, maybe even more apt as it applies to the economics than as it applies to the network.
Andy? You had your hand up?
No, I made the point up on the.
I missed it. Oh, I didn't just pay attention up there. Well, so tell me
why. Back during the discussion about what why you consider the internet liquid, and it was just reflecting back that it's also the idea of circuits versus packets. I mean, it had some baseline. That the thick circuits are solid and the flowing packets are liquid.
I mean, I think there's another relationship, which is that if you want to study, this is just a simple observation, if you want to study the internet, you want to study it like you study liquid things. Right? So if you're going to study the ocean, you don't go in it and say, okay, let's study this part of the ocean as if it's somehow separable from everything else. Right? It's not. It's not. Fundamentally, you have to rethink what you mean by that.
So. Actually, I'm going to suggest that you might need to think about internet almost like an ecology, because of the number of things that it somehow interacts with now. And that if you really want to study it, you have to ask ecological kinds of questions that have really broad footprints all over in so many different dimensions. But it's gone well beyond its original simple physical manifestation and the simple protocol structure and everything else. Because of the businesses, like Elliot was describing, that are becoming so much a part of it.
Sure.
David, can you tie this back to the discussion you were having on the mailing list a little earlier, and also sort of the idea of abundance and cooperation? And if you want to tie that to face changes, fine. And if you don't, if you want to just head back to that topic, I'm still really interested in what you were saying on the list.
The stuff I was saying on the list was mostly about economics, and actually sort of I have a bunch of sort of things like, there's been a bunch of comments up there about metaphors being bad things. I have a whole rant about why metaphors are bad, so I just did this metaphorical thing. I hate metaphors, but it turns out that the only way humans communicate is by metaphors, at least if you're in Lacan, right? So you have to use them one way or another. But the... But around the economics thing, one of the obvious things that Galbraith and other people have pointed out is that there's one way to study economics, which is as small increments that are presumed to be linear off some base that is kind of an equilibrium thing. And another way to look at economics, which is how does a collection of activity by humans create value? The metaphor in my mind is barn raising, right? So what lunatic would ever join his neighbors in barn raising, right? Does nothing for them. Maybe if you had an economy around barn raising, like where there was a controlled government, currency that when you went in and built the barn, then you got so much currency, and then you could force people to use the barn, then that would fit the way economics is mostly described, right? But the natural form of barn raising, where people just sort of go and build a barn, and they may never build a barn again. Why the hell did they do that? Right? Economics doesn't describe that. A lot of the stuff that we do on the internet is not
equilibrium economics. It's about making the pie bigger on the theory that if I make the pie a little bigger, maybe you'll make the pie a little bigger, and we're not going to worry too much about dividing it. It's sort of the, you know, the all boats rise when there's a rising tide, right? And that doesn't mean that that world always works that way, but I think we've seen the value of that since the beginning of human history. Cooperation often creates joint wins, and you don't have to measure who contributed the most to the cooperative behavior in order to carefully allocate the results. Almost any allocation works. That's kind of in the internet, sort of my analogy to this is sort of look at the early history of the internet. Why, how did the internet grow? It didn't grow because a bunch of ISPs said we want to build an internet. Right? It was because a collection of people had a network and they said, is it a win for me to join this internet and forward other people's packets on the theory that they'll probably forward packets for me? Right? And it's clear there's a joint win. Right? But if you had asked, you know, am I getting the better part of this deal? You probably would have dithered and not connected in the first place. The idea that you have to carefully allocate an account for all goodness, you know, when the future is more, if you actually, this is maybe more almost a religious statement, I'm like a religious guy, but we don't know anything about the future, right? We know precious little except that we generally try to make the future better than the past, right? And if you assume that most people are trying to make the future better than the past, then you generally can trust people within some bounds. Maybe some nihilists in the world who are trying to destroy the universe, but I don't think they're very confident. So my sense is generally cooperation generally produces good stuff, and we've observed that over and over again, and it's a pretty good theory that betting long in the stock market over the long run is a good thing. If the stock market were a fixed thing, then the short sellers would always be doing just as well as the long guys, and that's not been true over the long run. Right? So, account for cleverness and short run stuff. But
I think in a generally rising economy, if you think of oil trading in the oil patch in the boom days, or even irrational exuberance, that you don't have to do the accounting so carefully. In fact, it costs you money to do things carefully because you're not doing as many deals. We generally feel that way in our world. I'd also suggest that it's if you want to control politics and economy, it's very good to have kind of dire times because it causes people to draw in, I'd submit they even start to feel religious about things because their current opportunities are not great. I kind of long for the secularism of the 60s at fighter pilots.
Remember, sort of the other thing I started out with is that communications is ultimately about people. Right? It's easy to get people, and it's easy to get sucked in, whether it's economics or everything, to say that it's about these systems, and by the way, people are just the externalities that the system is serving.
Back to Doc. The people have to be. What did you say earlier, Doc?
I said too many things earlier.
We noticed that.
Yeah. Okay.
But about the people are currently incidental to the system. Was that the noun you used?
No.
We want them to be.
I don't know.
VRM.
There's the individuals are the independent variable and the company is the independent variable.
Right. And that's where you probably want it to be.
That's one way we want it to be.
Yeah. Right.
There are two things I want to check on. First is, I think one thing I took from the beginning of your talk that I want to confirm is that maybe we don't need to talk about the internet. The internet is actually an instance of something else. That in as much as that what you're trying to describe is some type of system of which the internet happens to be an example of. Okay, so I wanted to check on that. And then Elliot, when you were saying about
actually, I think we have a choice. We can. The internet will get old and brittle if we make the choice that the internet is an instance of something that we're evolving toward. The other possibility is that we could actually make the internet be that thing, but if we do, we have to change it. Maybe in the
United States. Okay. So you're saying that we're kind of on a, that there's a class of something and there's an option of whether the internet is an instance of it or the class itself.
Yeah.
Okay, so Nellie, what I heard you saying was is that here we've seen an instance of a basic accounting model, which is I can make an investment in a company, and that company has a value, and the valuation is based on I would get my money back in 10 years, or it would take some X amount of time for someone else to build the business or whatever, and that it's so liquid that that goes out the window, that model goes out the window. So
I'll let you finish the point.
Someone makes an investment and saying I'm only going to value this, the whole valuation is it kicks off this much money per year, and over some time it's recouped, which also sounds a lot like to me about the whole pattern of what happened in the telcos of the expectation of the cap of the capital expenditures and how long it would take to write those off.
Yeah, I wanted to make a very different point, though, with that example, which was that, first of all, that the size of that lead arbitrage economy is in the many billions of dollars.
Okay.
And that it is so liquid in the sense that it's so fluid and changing and dynamic that you could have what historically has been viewed as smart money make an objective determination that could be so wrong, because these markets are just so dynamic,
right,
and so fluid.
Right. But which is to suggest that if you have a rigid model of how some type of rigid accounting or economic model of your
yes.
investments, then you make basically say, well, this is going to continue for X amount of time.
That's exactly what happened,
and it can't continue.
Right. They employed the rigidity of a previous model. Which was to say, boy, we're making this investment at 3.5 times. This is a steal. That's the facts in that case, right? What a great deal that was. And they didn't recognize the fluidity and the liquidity that existed. That's a very nice way to put it.
Okay, hang on here. Rather than have particular elaborations, what I'd like to get is 3 volunteers to summarize what they heard. And David, you can be one of them if you want. I mean, summarize what, you know.
No, it's saying let other people.
Okay. There may not be any, but I'd like to see if someone has an ability to, like, in 3 or 4 sentences or maybe 2 or 3 minutes, you know, kind of. Okay, Doc.
Yeah, I a few sentences. What I've heard, what I've been hearing from David for a long time, and I think he's quite right, is that we're very captive to the metaphors that we've been using for a long time, conceiving the net as a solid thing, a set of tubes, even as an environment, a hard thing, a place. Where what we need, because the internet is inherently very flexy and non-rigid, is a liquid, a phase shift to a liquid metaphor that works at least as well as the solid metaphors that we've been using for some time. And the real challenge is to come up with that in a way that works. Close?
Summary statement?
Self-tip.
Yeah.
Okay.
And because I think what Dave's also kind of walking around is there is also in economics and a couple others this problem of kind of highly complex interdependent systems, and your comment about when you scale up a system to a certain size, or it's like we've all held a party and you scale it up to a certain size, it suddenly becomes a very different beast, and it acquires different physics. And like we've all had a party, it gets to a certain size and it acquires a different physics. What I think maybe we are all struggling with is we don't really have a good language either in economics or in network design or in sociology or anything to really talk about these large, complex, interdependent systems as separate unitary beasts that aren't command-controlled or aren't somehow cause and effect, because we love to create cause and effect, but rather they're just this endless series of sort of ringing effects through there. You then look at that, I think what the liquidity element comes is that your engineering or your design question becomes how do I use this liquid and kind of almost give it temporary structure or rigidity by putting a protocol in there or something like that. But your actual substrate you're working with is not actually in any way, shape, or form fixed. And so you're dealing with this highly fluid concept where I think, and this is to go, it's like the we don't even have the words to know what we're talking about yet. The internet's forcing us to confront it in one very real, very demonstrable place. But frankly, we can see it in slime molds, we can see it in the economy, we can see it in the stock market every day. We just prefer not to see it because it leaves us with this awful feeling there's no one in control. And so maybe we're lacking words. Is that fair? I don't know.
I like, I resonate with that. Okay. Every day people explain to me why the stock market went up and down, and I think it's all bullshit.
I the slime molds are moving in a different direction.
Summary statement, then?
I'd like to suggest that there might be something wrong with the attempt to apply the metaphors to the gross entity of the internet. I believe there are parts of it that are rigid and parts of it that are not. And if you ask questions about what is malleable in the networks, ecology, and what is not, you begin to try to apply your metaphor in a more refined way. And so I'd suggest that the next step here is to try to take these metaphors and apply them with a more of a microscope to understand more about this entity, because we're at too high a level of abstraction where you started, which is fine. And now to get utility out of it, I think we need to dig deeper and say which parts fit which metaphor.
Is it possible there's no metaphor that will fit it?
All metaphors are wrong.
Yeah.
By nature.
Except that one.
But metaphors are built from our experience, right?
Right.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, the first 3-minute card of the meeting has been played, after which, if there are no more 3-minute cards, I propose that we drink wine, talk among ourselves, wander off, go to sleep, etc., and then whoever wants to stay for the 5-minute talk about anything can. But so Pip Coburn, any other 3-minute cards, then a 15-minute break with possibly a little music if you guys feel like it, and then the 5-minute talks, which I know there are only 6 of them right now. Pip, 3.
David continually coming back and saying communications, it's not about network, it's about something about people. And the way I was taught to think about the word communication is very much at odds with how it's used out in society. That communication is an action taken towards the experience of oneness. It's an action taken towards common ground, towards community. So it's an experience. And instead, we think of communication services companies as if they're doing it for us. The internet doesn't do it for us. What I think about the internet is one of many tools, and we've been, I think, blessed over the last 15 years, all these possible tools that make possible things that could happen or that make possible communication, that David and I might be on common ground. And from there, good things will happen. Not that we have to agree. We could disagree, but we could hear each other. And I think that the metaphors, sometimes very valuable, sometimes not. In this case, I think a direct communication, that the internet is a tool. It may be a network, it may be a physical network. I'm not sure if I even need to know, other than it's something that makes possible a communication that I might have with Vint, meaning we might gain common ground, and from there the world becomes a better place. From there we might have commerce that might not have happened otherwise. We might avoid wars that might have happened otherwise. So I think the use of the word communication services for the past 50 years has been very egocentric, back to the companies that Steve is, and everyone rails against. Communication services companies, I'm going to do your service for you, Andrew. I don't think so. I think it's up to Andrew and Doc to figure out whether they can communicate or not. We're lucky to have some tools that we didn't have 100 years ago. I really, that's it. I think Communication is about an action taken towards the experience of oneness. Everything else is a tool that can go towards that if we use it really well. And if we don't, that's kind of a waste of time. And I'd hate the internet to be a waste of time. That's it.
All right.
Did you read the last line? And I think
say that again so that people back here can hear it.
And I think the internet is a waste of time.
I hate the waste of
internet. No, I hate the thought that the internet is this fabulous tool that can be nurtured and taken care of as a tool, not an end, but a tool for all sorts of great things to happen, that gets wasted. It's a tool that we screw up.
Okay, second 3-minute card, Rit.
Okay, I come to praise hierarchy, not to bury it. But first, the real reason I traded my incredibly valuable 3-minute card is that I
hate tomorrow anyway. So,
well, there you go. I really dislike the word "the internet is a tool." The internet can do this. You know, I've been in politics and the internet. Well, the internet's going to do this. The internet is Home Depot. It doesn't do shit. Okay, it's a place that supports tools and guilds. Okay, they do lots of stuff. Okay, we have to quit thinking about this foundation, this exoskeleton, as something that actually can do something. Okay, hierarchies. We love hierarchies. I mean, a slime mold doing that is a kind of a hierarchy, I guess. But people like new and exciting hierarchies. They don't like old and rigid ones. All right. So what we need to do is to be able to spin off these hierarchies very rapidly and then let them self-combust, because there's a more interesting new hierarchy you can go to. The problem we have is the solidification. Things got cooked up. You know, it's like, you know, bloods are, corporations are essentially metastatic. The only purpose of a corporation is to have a bigger corporation. Okay? Like you said about AT&T, Steve said about AT&T. The purpose of AT&T is to be a bigger AT&T. When I was in the Air Force, I knew the purpose of the Air Force is to be a bigger Air Force. It wasn't a fly more missions, it wasn't to put more bombs on target. The only thing that keeps the Air Force healthy in any way is physics. Because every once in a while, an airplane turns upside down on the ground and creates a black hole in the ground. You know, everybody goes, oh, fuck, it's a black hole, what happened? You know, and they bring all these stupid procedures back to here. But most organizations just don't have that benefit. So the point is, we do something here, it goes through its cycle, and then it breaks and becomes less interesting than competition. We've gotten really bad at building new, fresh, interesting hierarchies. I had a dinner a little over a year ago with Doc and somebody else, and I talked about this important notion, I think it's an important notion, in classic economics, called free entry. Free entry. The whole point of economics is if something isn't efficient, somebody else can start something up, and they're not barred from doing that. Well, of course, we don't see free entry. Yeah. So, a hierarchy is great until it doesn't work, and then the next one's got to be great, and soon. And the internet's Home Depot.
Oh, man. We've got 2 3-minute cards without triggering the buzzer. That's
pretty
good.
You left a pregnant question, which is how do we get free entry?
Well, tools. Okay. Is it a burner?
Yes.
Okay, burn. Baby, you raise your hand?
I absolutely did.
Okay.
Okay.
Anybody else got a burner? Anybody else got a burner? Okay. 15-minute break, and then we'll do the 5-minute talks. If anybody wants to sign up for 5-minute talk, here's a pen, here's a list.